From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, scandals hit the Obama administration, more military sex abuse, killer tornadoes in Texas, and Angelina Jolie makes a big statement on women's health. In Washington, fury upon fury. In the IRS uproar, House Speaker John Boehner said resignations would not be enough.
My question isn't about who's going to resign. My question is, who's going to jail over this scandal?
In the scandal over Justice Department snooping on AP phone records, Attorney General Eric Holder said a national security threat drove the urgency.
This is among, if not the most serious, it is within the top two or three most serious leaks that I've ever seen. It put the American people at risk, and that is not hyperbole. It put the American people at risk.
And Angelina Jolie announced she's undergone a preventative double mastectomy to fight cancer. Sharon Osbourne, who had the same surgery last year, applauded the iconic actress for her public stand.
She's so brave and is going to help so many women. And I think it makes her sexier than ever.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Josh Barrow of Bloomberg News, Susan Davis of USA Today, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Are you fired up on the scandals? One of them? All of them? Are these central issues? Can you believe we're hearing the word pimping tied to the U.S. military? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us from Washington is Susan David, Chief Congressional Correspondent for USA Today. Susan Davis, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, Tom.
With us from New York is Josh Barrow, columnist for Bloomberg News, lead writer for Bloomberg View's Ticker blog on economics, finance, and politics. David Brooks calls him one of the media's top young conservative thinkers. Josh Barrow, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Susan, and Josh.
Susan Davis, first to you. What do you make of this week? Is this what the rest of the year is going to be like? What kind of legs are under these scandals that are just stacked up one on top of another here?
I don't even know where to begin on that one, Tom. I do think, excuse me, that what we are seeing is, and I think it has become maybe a little bit of cliche in politics, but this week it's proven out to be very true that the second terms of administrations have in recent history often been defined by scandal that have sidelined the agenda that the president thought that they were going to be pursuing. I think that, you know, Benghazi started as, I think, somewhat more of a politically driven scandal that has not had as much interest among the American public as it has perhaps among Republican-based voters. But when you add in what happened this week with the IRS, which I think is something that it appeals to a much more broader audience's sense of outrage, the idea of the government spying on the largest news organization in the world, not spying, I shouldn't use that word, but obtaining records for the on the AP, the sexual assault in the military is sort of lending itself to this perception that this is an administration that is perhaps not fully in control of its administration, and in worse, perhaps perpetrating some things that are inappropriate, unethical, illegal, we don't know. They're obviously under review. I do think that if you know, it's hard to draw grand conclusions over one bad week, but it's obvious that Obama is going to need to get his arms around these situations, control them, and move on if he has any attempt at doing the broader things that he said he would like to do, namely immigration reform comes to mind, further deficit reduction or further budget deals with Republicans. And the administration is also not entirely given up on trying to again pass some form of gun legislation. But none of those things are going to be possible if more weeks continue the way that this one has.
We're going to look at these on their merits, on the facts. But Josh Barrow, just the big picture here. I mean, how do you see that? Your complimenter, David Brooks, is quoting Clinton Rossiter, who once wrote something like, the government is something like fire. Under control, it is the most useful of servants. Out of control, it is a ravaging tyrant. On the other hand, on those same pages, the editorial in the Times Today says, you know, the vast Republican opportunism is on display this week. What do you see going on here, Josh?
Well, I think opposition parties are always opportunistic in response to scandals that touch a president. But I think part of the reason that the Obama administration is at risk for being subsumed by scandals is that there isn't that much of a second-term agenda to subsume. Immigration, I think, is the one really big policy thing where we're actually fairly likely to see legislation get done this year. But the rest of the agenda is basically dead. I think gun reform is dead. I think the idea of a grand bargain on entitlement reform and a taxing increase is dead, especially now that the deficit picture seems to be improving on its own. I think that we will continue to talk about tax reform, but nothing will actually get done. So we need something to talk about. And given that the administration is not painting a way forward on policy that is likely to get enacted, it leaves scandals to talk about. I think the IRS scandal would be a big deal under any circumstances. I think it's the first scandal of the Obama administration that really the broader public is relating to. You don't have to be a conservative base voter to relate to the idea that you might be abused by the IRS. And obviously the behavior that the IRS was engaged in looked quite bad. The president himself was talking about how angry he is about it. The rest of these scandals, though, I think are not things that are going to be terribly politically damaging to the administration. I think Benghazi remains an obsession of the Republican base that is not connecting with the broader public, because I think people overall feel pretty good about how the president's foreign policy has been going, and they see Benghazi as a mistake that was a bad mistake. But when you look at it within the broader context of a successful foreign policy, people aren't going to hold that too hard against the president. And then I think these other things with the AP, I think that's an obsession of the press that the public is never really going to care that much about whether the AP's phone records got subpoenaed.
Though freedom of the press, end of the day, pretty big deal. Maybe that's my obsession, so be it. Let's dive into these one by one. Take on the IRS here. And here we are, 501c4s, these tax-exempt organizations, social welfare groups. The IRS is asked to figure out if they're political or not, because they can only be so political and still get this status. Well, targeted words, Tea Party, Patriot, more used there, and pretty much unanimous condemnation of that. Here was the president himself on Thursday saying the conduct was unacceptable.
It is just simply unacceptable for there to even be a hint of partisanship or ideology when it comes to the application of our tax laws.
There's the president. Here's California Republican Congressman, House Oversight Committee Chairman Daryl Issa, railing on it on Tuesday to CBS.
These were effectively ideological attacks. Whether they were done by partisans who were political appointees or not really doesn't matter. They targeted conservatives. They targeted people who wanted to teach the Constitution.
They just wanted to teach the Constitution. Here's Attorney General Eric Holder. He and Issa had some tough standoffs this week, but here he is saying we're going to look and see if there were criminal violations.
I think, as everyone can agree, if not criminal, they were certainly outrageous and unacceptable, but we are examining the facts to see if there were criminal violations.
And one more. How long will this go on? Could be a while if Senate Majority Leader, Republican of Kentucky Mitch McConnell, has his way. He called on President Obama to make all who knew about the IRS scandal available for questioning, no matter how high their position.
So this morning I'm calling on the president to make available, completely and without restriction, everyone who can answer the questions we have as to what's been going on at the IRS, who knew about it, and how high it went. No stonewalling, no more incomplete answers.
Testimony going on even this morning. The outgoing, ousted, temporary IRS chief apologizing for foolish targeting, GOP calling it the tip of the iceberg, the IRS man saying it wasn't deliberate, it wasn't intentional. Jack Beatty, take this one on first on its merits. We'll look at its impact politically, but on its merits, what do you see?
Well, the Inspector General report uses the phrase ineffective management. That's an understatement. For one thing, the IRS employees who did this classifying were incorrigible. I mean, after their boss told them to stop, they did temporarily, but then they went right back doing it again. And look at the at one point, this is from NPR, they pointed out the agency has 100,000 workers, and at one point just one bureaucrat was reviewing applications for tax-exempt status. So here you have just clearly a poorly run organization. It needs to be said that that its head was a Bush appointee, that it's that the acting head, the man who's just been fired or resigned, also a Bush appointee. Hard to see politics there. And the IG report sees no political influence from the White House, rather this kind of bureaucratic blundering and willful and blind violation of basic ideas of fairness in the administration of the law. But, you know, when you look within this scandal, there is another scandal. This is a fleeting matter. This will be corrected. What remains is the scandal of the dark money in our politics and the social welfare groups, the 501c4 groups that allow people to take donations anonymously and then spend them on political campaigns. And the law, which I have looked at, is a dog's breakfast of ambiguity. I mean, you just can't. Partly we can do some political action, but not too much. And it is just that needs to be straightened out. And this dark money business, which is a threat to our democratic system, that needs to be dealt with.
Susan Davis, the word impeachment has been thrown around on Capitol Hill this week. Is that serious?
You know, it's funny because I do think that both House and Senate Republican leaders have very actively been talking to their rank and file members and their committee chairman to tone down the rhetoric, to focus more on substance, and to try and really, particularly when it comes to the IRS matter and Benghazi, because there is a tremendous amount of interest in the Republican rank and file on that topic, to stay substantive and serious. Because I do think that in the Republican leadership level, there is some worry that if they start throwing the I word around, as one lawmaker called it, that they risk overplaying their hand and actually helping the president in the long run. So I think that there may be some mistakes, but I think from a leadership standpoint, they want to go slow and steady on these.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. White House and damage control over the IRS, AP, more military sex abuse, deficit coming down. Angelina Jolie steps up this week. Susan Davis is with us, chief congressional correspondent for USA Today. Josh Barrow is here, columnist for Bloomberg News, lead writer for the Ticker blog. And our own Jack Beatty, acting IRS Commissioner Steve Miller, is on his way out. He only had weeks to go, but the president has more or less shown him the door. He testified this morning before the House Ways and Means Committee, the first congressional hearing today on the issue of the IRS applying higher scrutiny to conservative groups.
I do not believe that partisanship motivated the people who engaged in the practices described in the Treasury Inspector General's report. I've reviewed the Treasury Inspector General's report, and I believe its conclusions are consistent with that. I think that what happened here was that foolish mistakes were made by people trying to be more efficient in their workload selection. The listing described in the report, while intolerable, was a mistake and not an act of partisanship.
Intolerable, but a mistake. We shall see. Susan Davis, what about on the Associated Press front? How do you see this one playing out? I mean, we talked with Floyd Abrams this week, big First Amendment attorney. He said, you can't do this. You can't just, it's the equivalent of sending the FBI into a newsroom to just take whatever they like in terms of records there. You don't think it has political legs, though, Susan?
Well, this is a good example of one of those stories that it's what surprises you is not what's illegal, but what's legal, in that what the Department of Justice did in obtaining these phone records is perfectly legal under current law. Whether it's right is obviously going to be a matter of debate. I do not believe at the end of the day the current law is going to be changed to prevent the Justice Department from ever doing it again. There is renewed talks of trying to reinvigorate what is known as a media shield law, which would provide clear protections to journalists in protecting sources in the process of news gathering. But, you know, even President Obama, when asked about this week, was very unapologetic about it and said, and from a commander-in-chief perspective, and this is consistent with previous presidents, that they are not going to sacrifice the national security of this nation. What we don't know, and this is where it gets murky and hard to say what's right and what's wrong, is the government's ability to claim national security interest. We don't know to the extent of whether that's true or not. Do they use it as a blanket reason to obtain records that maybe they don't need to. Maybe it's hard to get past that motivation, because once you claim the national security exemption or the safety exemption, then it provides a very strong blanket for what they're able to get. I do think the breadth of what they've done, and I think in part because it is the Associated Press, it's the oldest and largest news organization in the world. I think it's has a high value rating in the news media and is seen as sort of a nonpartisan important force in journalism. So I think that has made it even maybe what has drawn even more attention to it because of the news outlet. But is it going to change? I don't think so.
Certainly Eric Holder and the president himself willing to bring out the national security issue this week. Just yesterday, the president was with the Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan in Washington, saying leaks can put Americans at risk.
Leaks related to national security can put people at risk. They can put men and women in uniform that I've sent into the battlefield at risk. They can put some of our intelligence officers who are in various dangerous situations that are easily compromised at risk.
Sounds like a defense to me. Beth in Schenectady, New York is calling. Hi, Beth. You're on the air. What do you think?
Well, it has to be an imminent threat. Otherwise, you can call any document, government document, you can cover, protect any, and that's what the problem is. The problem is that the Obama administration has prosecuted more whistleblowers, and they have no business doing that. If there is not an imminent threat, then it's not, it is not their right. And it looks, what it looks like is that they're covering their own tracks. If they have nothing to hide and nobody's life or is on the line, especially, you know, what a case years ago regarding the sites in Eastern Europe in our rendition program, I guess that's one of the leaking cases that they prosecuted someone for, then it looks like the Obama administration has something to hide and is looking to see what the AP is knows about it.
Something to hide, but they say there's a leak here. It's putting Americans at risk. That doesn't concern you, Beth, or at least you want to still stick with the First Amendment freedom of the press in spite of that?
What's the risk? What's the risk? I want to.
Well, the risk is, they're suggesting an airliner coming down or something like that. I don't know.
An imminent risk, not
imminent.
Just,
well, I mean, he said it was the biggest national security risk he's ever seen in the top two or three, said Holder. I don't know. Josh Barrow, what do you say? I don't like this imposition on the press, but what about the security argument?
I don't see a First Amendment issue here. Nobody has had their First Amendment right to speak or to share information abridged.
Oh, come on. They're going and they're taking
the
records.
The APs or the
AP and the whistleblower, the leaker. Who's going to leak information to the press? Who's going to talk to the press if they can go in and scoop up all...
There's no First Amendment right to leak classified information. When you go out and seek a security clearance, you are agreeing to keep the secrets of the government in the capacity of your job. So there's no First Amendment right of the leaker. And the AP's First Amendment rights haven't been abridged. They haven't been made unable to report the information that they have. There's this idea in the press that basically that the leaking of classified information is necessarily a noble activity that shouldn't be prosecuted. But that's not true as a blanket statement. There are times when there's the way that I think this should work is that when there's when the government is doing something outrageous and the information about it is classified and a leaker feels a duty to the country to leak that information, then if as was the case with the Pentagon Papers, if it's outrageous enough, it will be politically impossible to hold them to legal account for it. But I don't think that we want a regime that allows people to sort of willy-nilly leak the secrets of the government. I think,
But there's another regime of people going in and scooping up phone records of a major news organization like this. Here's Floyd Abrams, big First Amendment attorney. We talked to him this week, drawing his parallel, Josh.
It's a very major step, very major, for them to go in and, in effect, act no different than if they had sent FBI personnel right into the AP offices and said, give us your phone records.
That's not the way we roll in this country, Josh.
Well, in some cases it is. There are various situations in criminal investigations where the government gets to subpoena information, including phone records. And the idea that we're supposed to somehow treat the AP differently because it's a media organization, I think, becomes increasingly untenable as the media becomes democratized. I mean, how do you create a media shield law at a time when anybody can start a Blogspot blog and anybody can be in an amateur capacity a member of the media?
Well, that is a thorny question. That's quite true. Kevin in Randolph, Massachusetts. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
In 2006, the Bush administration, I don't know if it came from the White House or the Justice Department itself, I don't know who initiated the action, but they made a big issue of strong-arming, trying to strong-arm Google into giving over the search records of millions of people without warrants. It was stated as a matter of national security. I and my fellow liberals and Democrats were outraged by that, and I really don't see the difference. The fact that it involves the press might make it a little bit more important, but...
So are you excusing the Obama administration with that or condemning them?
Absolutely not. I'm indicting them both. I mean, this is the same thing as what the Bush administration tried to do. Citing national security to go after search records on Google is no different than walking into the AP office, whether it's FBI agents walking in or gathering up phone information. And your guest seems to imply that it can be justified for national security, but, you know, checking the phone records of 150 or 200...
It was a big sweep. Kevin, we've got the point. Jack Beatty, but this is interesting territory we're in now. I mean, we're looking at this, at these 2 months of phone records that were scooped up here without consulting the AP. But we've got lots of listeners writing online saying, hey, what about the big, you know, is it the NSA Data Collection Center out in Utah where they're gathering everything that goes out on the phone and on the internet and able to go through all of that? The other side, Josh Barrow points out, look, what's the press now? You've got everybody with access to the internet publishing stuff. You want classified stuff just falling out of administration windows here and no big deal?
It's a dilemma, and the technology is changing to make it an even bigger one. I am just struck with, though, how this fits into a pattern for this administration. They have been neuralgic on the subject of leaks. People have pointed out they have, gone after more whistleblowers than all previous history. They have used this Espionage Act, which was, when it was enacted in 1917 in a war context, was considered to be very controversial and almost over the line in terms of giving the government undue power. And you know, when you look at it in detail, they have prosecuted a CIA officer for revealing the name of an agent, but they have never actually investigated the people who did the torturing under the previous administration. So they have just simply been, this is, I mean, someone called it surprising relentlessness. I guess surprising because we thought this was a liberal administration. We thought that the Constitution, President taught constitutional law. We thought this was, a commitment of his. It doesn't appear to be. And I'm not clear on this national security. It is so easy for these administrations to say national security when what they really mean is something could happen here that would embarrass me politically. It could be a terrorist attack, which would be terrible for the country, but it would also be a disaster for me politically, which is why leaving these decisions to, you know, the Justice Department alone is a very dangerous thing.
Well, I don't know. I mean, a terrorist attack is pretty bad in its own terms. Christy in Westchester, New York. Christy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I'm calling in with regard to the IRS segment that you had.
Yeah.
And I have a general feeling with regard to a lack of transparency in journalism, as I see it, as of late in recent years. And I'm listening to your segment, and you immediately, your speaker immediately starts to mention dark money associated with this topic, when how can we not be incredulous as to what is alleged to have happened, and all comment and agree only one type of organization was being targeted. There's no focus on MoveOn.org. If you're talking about dark money, that exists on both sides.
Well, I mean, but it seems like that's being criticized right up to the Rose Garden, isn't it, Christy? Everybody's saying singling out a particular party is outrageous. I guess the point Jack was making was, at the same time, we don't want dark money influencing our elections too deeply. Is that not fair?
We don't, but from my understanding, I have friends on both sides. I'm amazed at how big these organizations become and how they can target your special interests and offer you products that are associated
yeah.
with your political ideology.
Yeah.
And so now we're having the IRS only target one ideology and allowing the other to flourish in the way that it's doing pretty darn good.
Well, let me give a little more noise to that then, if you like, Christy. Here, this is, we're just getting this tape in from the hearing this morning. This is the House Ways and Means Committee on this IRS issue. Here was the committee chairman, Dave Camp, Republican, Michigan, characterizing what had happened with the IRS as an abuse of power.
I'm sure you're aware of the saying that the power to tax is the power to destroy. Well, under this administration, the IRS has abused its power to tax, and it has destroyed what little faith and hope the American people had in getting a fair shake in Washington. This will not stand.
From that and more, you've got Republicans talking impeachment now. Josh Barrow, you wrote this week, the IRS did not make this mess because its employees are stupid or because they have a political vendetta. Our caller's not so sure. What do you mean by that, Josh?
Well, I think that the regulations that the IRS was trying to enforce were sort of terminally vague. The rule about these groups are called social welfare organizations, but I think focusing on that name actually confuses the issue, because when you look at the legal definition of what you have to do to qualify as a social welfare organization, you don't necessarily have to do anything that looks recognizably like promoting the social welfare. They can do unlimited amounts of lobbying on basically any policy topic that they are formed to create pressure on, so long as they are not going after the narrow financial interests of their backers. And I really mean narrow by that.
But they cannot be primarily political in their mission.
They can't be primarily electoral. They can do they can have a 100% lobbying operation. The only thing that they can't do primarily is try to influence elections.
Yeah.
And so that's what the rules say. So the line that you can draw between what's electoral activity and what's not is often kind of fuzzy. You can do so-called issue advertising, and it can be vague as to whether or not you're actually directly influencing an electoral outcome with that or trying to broadly change public opinion on a matter. So the IRS doesn't really have a good way to review these applications and determine in advance whether a group is going to run afoul of the 501c4 rules or not.
I mean, it looks ham-handed, but I would hate to be
right.
handed this task, though
right.
this does not look like the way to go at it. Bill in New Orleans. Bill, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, I'm suffering from a weary sense of outrage here at the nonsense that has continued to manifest itself for the last 5 years, 5.5 years. The first 4 years, the goal of the Republican Party was stated to be keeping the president from being reelected, and now that seems to have been modified to reflect a desire not to let him accomplish anything. But you know, I voted for Obama, and I also voted for Ronald Reagan at one time. And I also voted for Richard Nixon at one time.
So you see non-issues here, and Bill? Is that what your point?
What I see is an abdication of responsibility by the Congress on all sides, in that they choose to spend more time addressing political issues rather than things that go to the greater good of the country. There appears to be no recognition of a need to address the greater good of the country. We hear a lot of posturing that has no value other than political. It's very short-term, interest-oriented.
Bill, I've got it. We've got Susan Davis, who covers Congress, and let me pick it up with her right there, and I appreciate your call from New Orleans. I mean, Susan, how about it? You know, what is being held up on Capitol Hill this week in the face of these furies, and should it be?
Well, one point that I think is worth making, particularly on the IRS stuff, as we've used the word impeachment a couple times, I do think it's important just to note that there has been zero line connected between what happened in the IRS at the White House. The IG report said that they testified that this morning on Capitol Hill. Now, that may change, and this is an ongoing investigation, but it does seem important to note that there has been no suggestion that anyone in the White House had any role in what happened at the IRS. Another point on when we talk about dark money in politics, it's not only the idea that these groups have attempted to influence elections. But another reason why both Republicans and Democrats on the Hill have previously, before the scandal came to light, looked at these groups is it's not just because of their political agendas, but because of the status they receive as a tax-exempt status. And the question of whether were they abusing the tax code to not pay their taxes, which is sort of a sub-issue section of all this. You know, there's substance here. I think that obviously any president in is going to have opposition party on the Hill if an opposition party controls a chamber. I think determining the difference between substance and politics is going to be very difficult in a lot of these cases because often you can't separate the two.
Well,
but I don't think that what's happening now is particularly unusual. There just seems to be a crush of it in a very short period of time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, shocking violence in New Orleans. 19 at a Mother's Day parade injured in a wild street shooting. New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu, at a press conference yesterday, referenced the Mardi Gras chant, "We won't bow down," to evoke the city's resilience.
We are going to do what we have to do to protect our culture and our great city. We will not bow down. That is a familiar phrase to all of us in New Orleans, and we will not back up.
An amazing viral video. Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield, suddenly a star, sang David Bowie's Space Oddity while dancing in zero gravity aboard the International Space Station.
This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade.
And NBC's The Office ended last night. After 9 seasons, beloved couple Jim and Pam finally leave Scranton, Pennsylvania for Austin, Texas.
Where would we go?
Austin? Maybe.
I promise you, you don't have to do this for me.
I'm doing it for us.
And off goes The Office. We're looking at a week in the news. White House in damage control. More military sex abuse. Deficit coming down. Angelina Jolie stepping up. Susan Davis is with us, chief congressional correspondent for USA Today. Josh Barrow is here. He's lead writer for the Ticker blog on economics and finance and politics. Bloomberg News, Bloomberg Views. Jack Beatty's here. The White House putting out a lot of emails around the messaging question, around what happened in Benghazi from those early days after the attack last September 11th. According to the emails, the CIA took charge of creating talking points about the incident that killed 4 Americans, saying the intelligence community didn't know whether or not it was a terrorist attack. Of course, others were in there, too. Before the release, some Republicans had accused the administration of knowing it was a terrorist attack, but telling the public it was instead related to an anti-Islamic video. Well, Jay Carney on Thursday, White House Press Secretary, said no.
That was information that was provided to us by the CIA, provided to Congress by the CIA, that this was an intelligence assessment. Republicans pounced and attacked and suggested that improperly the White House or others altered those talking points, changed the intelligence assessment. And what the release of these emails show is that Republicans are wrong. They were wrong then, and they're wrong now. And this has been a highly politicized affair.
Wrong then, wrong now. Josh Barrow, what do you say?
Well, the main thing I see here is an attempt between the State Department and the CIA to avoid blame over this incident. And I think it's unprofessional. I think these are both arms of the government that are supposed to be charged with protecting national security rather than bureaucratic infighting and trying to shift blame between each other. But it's a different story from the one that that Republicans have tended to spin about this, where it was an Obama administration effort to avoid negative political fallout from this. So I think it's, you know, I think it's embarrassing for the government in the aftermath of this, but I think it's actually less political of an issue than it's often been made out to be.
Susan Davis, the sound from Capitol Hill, though, is that we're going to be talking about Benghazi for a long time.
Yes, I think we will. I think part of it is, particularly in the House, Republicans control the House, and there is a tremendous amount of interest among this issue in the Republican base. Pew Research put out a poll this week that showed sort of the divide on this, in that not a majority of Americans are not paying attention to Benghazi. Only about 44% of Americans said that they are even familiar with what it is. But within, when you break it down among partisan affiliation, this issue has captivated Republican voters. Some 41% of Republicans said they thought it was one of the biggest scandals in presidential history. I mean, this is just, this is classic red meat politics. And I think even a bill in the House to have a special committee on Benghazi to further investigate has more than half of the Republicans in the House signed on board to it. So, you know, this is just something that from House Speaker John Boehner on down has presented a tremendous amount of interest in part because their constituents are tremendously interested in what happened. It's hard to – Benghazi is certainly a situation where I think that the political motives are much more clear in the sense that one of the underlying stories in all of this is Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State when Benghazi occurred, and the likelihood or unlikelihood that she may run for president in 2014 – or excuse me, obviously in 2016 – and whether this is part of a broader campaign to maybe weaken her as she moves forward in that decision-making process.
Let's go to Janine in Iowa City, Iowa, on that. Jack, I'll be right with you. Janine?
Yes, one of the things I have a concern about is the fact that I do think this is a very political issue because, yes, perhaps things could have been done differently, but what about the Valerie Plame issue, you know, when she was suggesting that perhaps there really were no weapons of mass destruction, and, you know, it destroyed her career, and the Republicans didn't seem too excited about it, and we did go to war in Iraq, and many Americans lost their lives over this false information. And I agree with your current speaker about the fact that I think the Republicans are trying to weaken a very strong candidate for the presidency in Hillary Clinton.
I mean, she was Secretary of State. Does she deserve some heat for what happened in Benghazi and the messaging that came after, Janine?
I'm just saying, why wasn't the Bush administration held to the same level of scrutiny that is being placed on Obama and Hillary Clinton right now?
Well, I mean, there was a lot of noise about Valerie Plame. Jack, I'm sorry. What are you thinking here?
Well, I just wanted to point out that, yes, this is something. Benghazi is a hot issue for the Republican base, but it's tempting the Republicans already to overreach. Our friend Major Garrett on CBS News last night reported that the Republican, House committee members or staffers altered the Benghazi emails that were dumped out last Friday. They altered them. They cut phrasing that. And the effect was to make it look like the White House had a large part, or at least a part, in changing, massaging the talking points, whereas the real email versions, which the White House in defense released on Wednesday, they didn't show that. Now, perhaps it was carelessness on the part of the Republican staffers, but perhaps it was malice. But in any case, if the issue is doctoring things, it looks like those emails were doctored.
I want to go to the issue of sexual abuse in the U.S. military. Another round of headlines this week. It seems they just go on and on. This time, another military leader in charge of preventing sexual abuse, this time at Fort Hood, in trouble. A long litany of things, including pandering, synonym for pimping in the military, got lots of people's attention. This was New York Democratic Senator Kristen Gillibrand on Thursday talking about this issue that just doesn't seem to go away, urging reform of the system that appears to protect sexual offenders.
The issue of sexual violence is not new. It has been allowed to go on in the shadows for far too long. And for all of us, we believe enough is enough. It's time to change this system that has been held over since George Washington, that is simply not working today for the men and women who are serving.
Susan Davis, what's in the works in Congress on this front? The president is talking with Chuck Hagel, Secretary of Defense, saying, I want meetings all the time. I want you on this. Hagel's saying he's going to do it. Is Congress going to get back into this?
That's a great question. I think part of what we don't know is, how do you solve the problem? We know what the problem is, but how can Congress actively change the culture of the military? Particularly because I think, and my colleagues at USA Today have been writing extensively about this issue. Part of this is a culture thing, and I don't know how Congress could weigh in and change the culture of the military. Part of it is also, and this is important to remember in how these assault cases are discovered and prosecuted, is that the military in many ways operates under its own legal system, that they prosecute their own, that their commanding officers tend to be the final authority on many matters that in civil society would be go through a court system. And that raises tremendously complicated legal questions over what Congress can do. I do think that there is tremendous amount of public pressure that Congress can put on the Pentagon to act, and also that Congress funds the Pentagon, and that the annual appropriations process, which is where we figure out how much money we should spend on what, is underway, and that the defense appropriations bill is always a top issue for Congress. And there's ways that you could obviously spend resources to maybe increase program awareness, to help victims, to change cultures. But I would say at this point in time, they don't have a clear plan going forward over how you change a problem that is so systemic across all branches of military service.
Josh Barrow, this week the president's saying this has come to the point where it is affecting the effectiveness of the U.S. military. That's, talk about red lines, that's got to be a red line.
Oh, I think so. And I think this is the rare scandal that is actually going to raise awareness about a problem in a productive way in Washington and lead to some reforms that help. Senator Gillibrand has legislation that would change the way the military prosecutes sexual assaults, that would remove remove decision making that currently is within the chain of command of the person making the complaint. The idea would be to make it easier for service members who have been sexually assaulted to report and get their assaults prosecuted, because the vast majority of sexual assaults in the military, they think, are not even being reported right now. And I'm fairly hopeful that it would be possible to change the culture in the military on this, because the military is such a hierarchical organization. I think we've seen this with the implementation of Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal over the last mm-hmm. couple of years, where there were all these fears raised about how it would be terrible for morale in certain parts of the military, and a lot of service members would have strong objections. But in practice, it seems to be that if you have a message coming down from the top that says, this is the way this is going to be, we're going to change the culture on this matter, you can actually achieve a lot of top-down change. And so I think if leadership in the military started to take the sexual assault issue seriously, they could really do a lot to change the culture within the military, especially in conjunction with changes in those rules about how these cases are prosecuted.
Well, we will see. I mean, it's easy to find the video roles of Secretary of Defense after Secretary of Defense saying, this is a problem, we're going to get on top of it, and clearly they haven't. On Monday, we're going to talk about this chain of command issue, the inviolability there of maybe near the heart of this problem, or at least a big part of it. We will look at that at that point. I want to look at this deficit issue. Jack, surprising numbers this week. The Congressional Budget Office saying that, you know, projected deficit is coming down for this year. That means the standoff over the debt ceiling will be pushed out into the fall, won't show up in the summer. The numbers look better. They're still big. We're still projecting $642 billion budget deficit for this fiscal year. But it's not that trillion with a T number that we've become accustomed to in recent years.
No, indeed. And by 2015, just around the corner, it's going to be $378 billion, which is practically pocket change after the standards of recent years. Yeah, I mean, and you know, as people look at the why, there are all kinds of reasons. The economy is recovering. There have been tax increases. There have been spending cuts and so on. But one element of this, I think, is worth focusing on because, of course, the Affordable Care Act, this is its year to be implemented. Total health care spending grew at its lowest annual pace last year in five decades. Now, why is that? Well, all sorts of reasons. There was a recession and so on. But part of it also is Medicare spending, which isn't dependent or isn't as sensitive to the economy as that is, people aren't losing their insurance. Medicare spending also came down, by 2%. And some people are thinking, of course, you could say they perhaps have a stake in this, are saying, well, maybe the reason is that providers are already building in expectations about the Affordable Care Act, which has all kinds of mechanisms in it to, you know, make spending more accountable. For example, readmission to hospitals. Hospitals that have a high readmission rate for Medicare patients, they don't get as much money as those that have a clear rate or a clearer rate. So perhaps already we're feeling some good results of the Affordable Care Act.
But that wouldn't show up in these numbers. This is the federal deficit. This is not, is it? That's not, does it have to do with this?
This is part of the total. It's part of the total picture of federal spending. But it's just that. But because you know, for the future, that's the big problem: Medicare, healthcare spending. That's at the huge after 2023. The deficit's going to go up again, largely because of that. And if these early signals bear fruit, early seeds bear fruit. Perhaps Medicare spending can be contained.
Maybe. Boomers aging, healthcare costs going to go up. Susan Davis, what do you see in these numbers on the deficit?
I think it was short-term good news and a long-term reminder that we still do not have a firm handle on our debt and deficit problem. As Jack noted, you know, the deficit is down better than expected. It's going to continue to go down through 2015. Big whoop. That's 2 years. And then the trajectory turns back around and we start going back up. Mm-hmm. And why is that? And that is because, the Affordable Care Act, that is obviously we're going to have to wait and see the economic impact of that. Very divisive over, you know, which way that could go. In some ways, it's saving costs. In other ways, actuaries have said that they think premiums will rise, that the costs will shift, but also the boomer population are going to be joining Medicare in unprecedented numbers, and the deficit is going to continue to grow again. And that is the question that we have not been able to answer, and also the question of paying the interest back on our debt. And as interest rates have been forcibly held to very low levels, and as the economy hopefully continues to improve, and if those interest rates continue to rise, the interest on the debt is going to continue to increase. And these are long-term problems, and Washington doesn't tend to deal with long-term problems. So I think that the deficit news of this week, that it was down and it's going to be down for the next 2 years, has in some ways taken a lot of pressure off of the current budget debate in Washington. We're going to have a vote to increase the debt ceiling later this year. I think there was a lot more fire underneath that issue when we thought we might be dealing with more years of trillion-dollar deficits. The fact that it's going down does, I think, change the political calculation, but it doesn't change the problem.
Medical news on other fronts this week. The life sentence for the abortion provider Kermit Gosnell in Philadelphia. No parole, murder. The verdict came down in the killing of 3 babies in his clinic. And then Angelina Jolie with her news right out front, essay in the New York Times saying, I had a double mastectomy because I've got the BRCA1 gene, this genetically troubling gene for breast cancer in my family. Her mother died of it. Susan, I mean, here's a moment where she's getting a lot of credit for this. This is a sex symbol in Hollywood, but very forthright about what she's done and why. Opened up a conversation that maybe is freeing more women to think and talk about this very openly.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's nothing but good things to say about Angelina Jolie doing this. I think in part because she is probably one of the most famous women in the world. And when she writes an op-ed in the New York Times, the sort of secondary press wave you get from that is huge. And that I would imagine that there's a lot of women in the country and in the world that don't even know these genetic tests exist. And, you know, it's almost like celebrity endorsement, but in this case, it's for genetic testing. So it's good. And bravo to her.
A kind of candor that is uncommon in any realm, and maybe especially in Hollywood, exercised maybe for some good by Angelina Jolie this week. I want to thank all 3 of you for being with us this hour. It's been terrific to have you. Susan Davis, Chief Congressional Correspondent for USA Today. Thank you so much for joining us, Susan.
Thanks, Tom.
Josh Barrow, Bloomberg News, lead writer for the Ticker blog there at Bloomberg Views. Josh, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks, Tom.
And Jack, great as always to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
On Monday, we're going to look at North America's new status as big energy producer and how it changes geopolitics and our energy future. This is On Point. Join us then. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for being here.